It's 11:10, so we can get started. Are there any questions? I know there are, because lots of people came up to me with good questions at the end of yesterday's talk. I did ask people to ask them again so other people could hear the answers. Because as usual, when there's a good question, many people want to hear the answer. Yes? Should you bring your books to this lecture every day? You may if you want to, but I won't be assuming that people have brought their books. Yes?
Is it recommended that you use Linux and
Emacs text editor, or can you just use the Windows and regular? Excellent question. Is it recommended that you use Linux for running Haskell? And the answer is no. You can use any operating system you want. Haskell is available on Windows. It's available under various Linux distributions, and it's available under Mac OS, which is what I'm running it under. And you may use any of those. The version of Haskell you want is something called GHC, the Glasgow Haskell compiler. As I mentioned yesterday, I was working with the team at Glasgow that developed that. The main person behind that is Simon Peyton-Jones, and also his assistant, Simon Marlowe. They were just given the SIGPLAN Software Award for Haskell, the second time the award's been given. So that's available from Microsoft, where they both work at Microsoft Research in Cambridge. If you just type Haskell into Google or another browser, it will probably take you right away to Haskell.org, and from that you can quickly get to downloads of GHC and other implementations of Haskell. GHC is by far the one that's most widely used. You'll want the libraries that come with it. There's something called the Haskell platform. You just download that, and it should pretty much just run. Somebody had their hand up with a question.
Do you need to bring the textbook to tutorials?
Do you need to bring the textbook to tutorials? Again, you may, but I don't think that would be referred to particularly. As I said yesterday, what you do need to do is do the assigned tutorial in advance of the tutorial and bring a printout of your answers with you. That is essential.
When do the tutorials start? Next week?
Tutorials start next week.
They will. In functional programming and computation logic?
I believe in both subjects, both in computation and logic and in functional programming. As you'll see, I'm trying to repeat the questions when they're asked. If I don't repeat the question, please remind me to. As you may know, these lectures are being videoed. And that's one reason why I have a mic on me. So if I repeat the question, that means people watching the video will be able to hear the question. And I guess if you don't want to be seen on the video, you have to sit right in the back because the video doesn't catch that. Otherwise, it might get the back of your head. Somebody else had their hand up. Which release of the compiler are you using in the DICE labs? I don't recall off the top of my head. Haskell is changing all the time, but we're not using any of the most recent features, so the release is fine.
I think it's 7.03.
And somebody knows better than me, they think it's 7.03. Yes?
Are the exercises, the tutorial exercises, you have to do on the computer or print it out?
Oh, good question. So should you do the tutorial exercises by hand or on a computer? You can do them by hand first if you want. I think that's a good idea for feeling if you understand things. But it is very helpful to do it on the computer, because the computer will tell you if you got it right or not. Right? That's what I like about the computer, is you have this slave that tells you if you got it right or not. That's what makes it fun for me. Okay, those were excellent questions. Any other good questions? Okay. Let's get started. Let's see. I will just very quickly review the most important things yesterday, although I expect, is there anybody here who wasn't here yesterday? Let's try that. Raise your hand if you weren't here yesterday. No, no new people. Okay, so you know to get the textbook and read the assignments. You know that there are labs this week. How many people went to the lab yesterday? Great. How did that go? Was good? Didn't work. You couldn't submit your work yet.
Yes.
So you could do the work and see that it worked, but you couldn't actually submit it.
Yep.
Okay. So the submit's not actually set up yet, but will be by the end of the week. Okay. Any other comments from yesterday? Yes. You can submit it from anywhere as long as it's a DICE computer. You can sometimes log on remotely. There are various things about intranets and extranets, and I think sometimes people have had trouble doing some things from outside the university. But I'll let you discover how that works out. There certainly are ways of getting into the intranet from outside the university. Yes? So one person told you that there's currently difficulty using SSH, the secure shell, to log in from outside. There's no problem. It works.
No, no, I use that, but I won't be able to start the work through SSH as well.
Right, so the way to get onto a DICE computer from outside, there are various ways, but one very common way is to use a system called SSH, which stands for Secure Shell. And you're saying that that's one way of doing it. You can use it to get into a DICE computer, and then you can submit from there, right. Okay, so you know about doing the computer labs, good. And you've already asked questions, so I'm sure you're aware that tutorials begin next week. And right, you've all seen me jump up and down about this once, but it's so important I'll jump up and down again. Please forgive me. Do the tutorial before the tutorial, because that's the way to learn the material. Okay, and I think you all know that the only things that are actually marked to count towards your score on the class are the class test and the final exam. The reason for that is we want your only motivation in doing the other things to be to learn to do something. And that's what they're set up, so that you can learn things from doing them. If you don't do them, you won't learn the material, and you will fail the exam. It's that simple. So let's see. I got this far yesterday. I realized I was emphasizing quite a bit how excited I was that all these banks are using functional programming. And then I thought, gosh, that makes functional programming seem very materialistic, doesn't it? And of course, it is great that there are lots of businesses that see this as important to getting their job done. But the real reason that I'm interested in functional programming is truth. And beauty. There are few things more interesting than trying to figure out how to structure information. Right? There are, up until recently, there have basically been only two major ways in which we can communicate things. Prose, you write it down, or mathematics, you write down a formula for it. Only in the last 50 years have we had a third method of communication. And that third method of communication is programming, being able to write down a program to describe something. So if you think about it, that's pretty major, having a new way of going about doing things. Okay. And we also all know from using systems like Google that having large numbers of computers running programs can let you do things by brute force that you could never think of tackling by hand. And that in and of itself gives new insights into doing things. Right? Science is being completely revolutionized because you can build enormous databases of information and then process that information. So in biology, in astronomy, in physics, things are completely different because of this ability to store and retrieve information using computers. So the ability to write a program really is as important as the ability to use prose well. Right? And you should all think of yourselves as aspiring poets. You are trying to write programs that are poetry. And for me, the quest for languages that let you write that poetry is the most interesting thing. So that's how I got into functional languages. And the fact that you can use them to make lots of money is just an added bonus, which is usually the case with truth and beauty. Right? The fact that truth and beauty has many practical applications is, I think, no coincidence. But very often, if you look for the beauty and the truth, then the other practical things will follow. As I've mentioned, programming languages come in many families. Two of them, which you will get exposed to this year, are functional languages and object-oriented languages. And you're going to be learning Haskell, which is a prominent functional language, but there are lots and lots more of them. Okay. And later you'll be learning Java, an object-oriented language, but there are lots and lots more of them. And then you can say, well, wait a minute. If functional is so good and object-oriented is so good, why don't you get them both together and have object-oriented functional languages? And if you look at this list, you will see that there are two, at least, three. F-sharp, OCaml, and Scala appear on both lists. So, sorry? And JavaScript. Thank you. And JavaScript. All of those appear on this list, which have both functional and object-oriented features. Somebody had their hand up for a question. So JavaScript is very much coming from the commercial side. It lacks some of the things I find most beautiful in functional languages. But F-sharp, for instance, started on the research side by researchers at Microsoft Cambridge, and it's now a Microsoft product as part of the .NET framework. So a lot of us in the functional community are very excited about that idea that a major firm like Microsoft is now supporting functional programming as one of the things they expect people to do. Erlang is worth mentioning because it was developed by Ericsson, a telecommunications firm. They use it to build phone switches. Phone switches have to be highly reliable. So they used Erlang to program their AXE phone switch, which has 99s reliability. 99s means that it is up 99.999999% of the time. When something is up that often, it's really hard to measure how much downtime it has because it's down so rarely. Okay. So that, and the functional programming techniques are heavily used both in making it concurrent, run on multiple computers, and on giving it such high reliability. And then I'll also mention Scala, which was developed by my colleague Martin Odersky. Martin and I both did work on adding generic types to Java. So when I say, I'll mention that in a moment. But he then went on to develop Scala, which is a functional language designed to interact very well with Java. So Java runs on something called the Java Virtual Machine, which is implemented on many, many different computers. That's why it's easy to run Java on many different machines. Scala compiles to the same machine, same virtual machine, so that it's very easy to run Scala and Java together on different machines. Similarly, the .NET platform is also something called a virtual machine, and it runs C# and F# and Visual Basic and many other languages. So Microsoft has their own virtual machine, the .NET machine, and then Sun, which is now Oracle, has its one, the Java virtual machine, and there are major functional languages, F# that compiles to the Microsoft platform and Scala that compiles to the Java platform. Erlang is just its own thing. But that thing has built into it things that make concurrency and distribution work very well. I should explain a couple of these words, right? Distribution is when you have computers in different places. So when you're using the World Wide Web, that's an example of distribution. Concurrency means using more than one computer at once. So distribution is an example of concurrency, okay? But how many of you with laptops in this room are using concurrency right now? Nobody? Yes? If you have a quad-core processor, that means there are four computers that you want, right? So you should be able to get something to run four times as fast if only you can figure out how to get four programs to do the task together. And this has become very important. As you might know, how many people have heard of something called Moore's Law? Right, quite a few of you. So Moore's Law was formulated by one of the founders of Intel, the company that makes chips for most of the computers that we use. And Moore's Law noted, he just noticed, and this was back, I think, in the late 60s, early 70s, he'd noticed that every 18 months that the number of components you could get on an integrated circuit doubled. So this means you could do twice as much for the same price every 18 months. So that means after 3 years, right, 18 months twice, you could do four times as much. Wait another 18 months, you can do eight times as much, and so on. Well, 1970 was, what, more than 30 years ago. So that would be 20 instances of doubling, right? What is 2 raised to the 20th power? About 1 million, right? 2 to the 10th is about 1,000. 2 to the 20th is about 1 million. So computers have gotten 1 million times more powerful since then. So this has been a great help for those of us working with computers, because programs that we used to write that were way too expensive to run now can run very cheaply. And basically, we could do as awful a job as we wanted writing the software, and it didn't matter, because if you waited just a while, the computers would get fast enough to catch up. Right? This has been the history of computing for the last 30 years. And it's one reason that computers have become such wonderful tools for productivity. Alas, this has come to a stop. Nobody now can make a computer. It used to be you wait 18 months, your computer runs is half the size, it runs twice as fast. They can't shrink them anymore. They've made them as small as they know how to make them. So what they're doing now is they're making larger chips, and they can make larger chips every 18 months. So you're still getting twice as much power, twice as many components every 18 months, but it's no longer twice as fast. So what they've done is they said, well, right, if we can't make one computer twice as fast in 18 months, we'll make two computers, and we'll double the number of computers every 18 months. And that's what was happening. So a while back, you would get chips, and they were single-core computers. People didn't bother to say single-core, because that's what they were. Everything was. Then you start getting dual-core computers, two on a chip, and now you're getting quad cores, four on a chip. Wait a little bit, we'll have eight on a chip. Wait a bit more, we'll have 16, and so on. So all of a sudden, writing parallel programs is really important. It's absolutely vital. And all three of these systems, Erlang, F-sharp, and Scala, sell themselves as saying, look, we will make it easier for you to write concurrent programs and distributed programs. And because of multi-core machines, because of the web, concurrency and distribution are becoming increasingly important. So I'd like to be able to tell you, so we've got all lined up, all the right ways of doing this, and we're going to teach all of them to you. But the answer is that although some of the most important, there's been lots and lots of good research on concurrency and distribution. Some of the most important research was done here by Robin Milner and others. But the plain answer is, although we know a lot about it, we don't really know how to teach it to a first-year class. We've not made it as simple and straightforward as here's the way to go about doing it. And in all of these languages, well, Erlang has a particular way of doing it that works very well. But in F-sharp and Scala, basically, you can get many different libraries for doing concurrency, and each of them does it in a different way. Haskell, as well, has many different libraries for concurrency, each one doing it in a different way. Simon Peyton-Jones, who I mentioned, is the main developer behind Haskell now, has loads and loads of papers on how to do concurrency in Haskell, and many of them are about different techniques. So we don't know the answer yet. And I hope that you guys will help us, help the world, in finding the right way to program computers in a concurrent and distributed way, because that's the most important question facing us. And there are lots of ways to do it. I hope you'll have fun learning about some of them. As I mentioned, we don't say too much about that in this course, because we're going to get started in the simple way, just doing one computer. Any questions about all that? I guess I should mention just quickly what I wrote down here. It's been the case in the past that object-oriented is what we call mainstream computing, and that functional was sort of a sideline just done by a few academics. As will be clear from what I've told you about the development, that's rapidly changing. So sort of here I want to make the contrast between, well, functional languages are wonderful, but what people tend to use is object-oriented languages, so those have all the libraries. And sometimes if you want to get something done, having the right library available is very important. But that's changing. So I'm not sure I should emphasize that anymore. There are lots and lots of examples of functional programming in the real world. I've already talked about its use in quite a few financial institutions now for various forms of automated trading. Basically, the reason that financial institutions, banks, and other traders are so interested is the faster they can get the programs written, the better. And functional programs tend to be more compact than object-oriented programs. And the reason for that is exactly what I was talking about yesterday, right? If you need to do something one location of an array at a time in ticky, 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 ticky style, that's more to think about than doing it in whoosh style. So not surprisingly, the whoosh style means you can develop programs more quickly. And that's why financial institutions are so interested in learning about functional languages. Were there any questions there? Okay. And major places, Twitter was talking about using Scala in their infrastructure at the CUFP talk that I went to last Saturday. Yahoo was talking about using functional languages in the one before that. There was a games developer talking about using Racket, another functional language, in developing their games. So there are many, many real world uses. The one that I'll mention just a little bit here is MapReduce, used at Google. We'll say more about that later, but a little ways into the course, you'll be learning about two functions called map and reduce. And those are the essence of the major algorithm that Google uses in running queries over many, many computers. Right? So when you send a query to Google, they don't just find one computer to run it on, but they have literally warehouses full of computers that they use for running queries. And the secret to that is using an idea that they took from functional programming. I've already mentioned that Erlang, F-sharp, and Scala are currently attracting a lot of interest from developers. And to my surprise, Haskell really seems to be as well at this point. There's a lot of people out in industry learning Haskell on the side. And many, many features from functional languages, many features started in the functional world, and then the people in the object-oriented world said, hey, that's a good idea, let's do that. And so they moved over from the functional world into the object-oriented world. And examples of such things are garbage collection, which is used to manage memory in the computer. Basically, you allocate lots of locations in the computer, and garbage collection discovers, oh, that's not being used anymore. I can garbage collect it and then use it again. Higher order functions, which we'll say a lot more about later in the course, have become standard in almost every programming language. Generics have become standard in every programming language that has that's statically typed. These are all dynamically typed, which is why they don't use generics. But if you have a static type system, as Haskell does, then generics are important. So generics come from something called the Hindley-Milner system, which was developed by Roger Hindley, a logician, and Robin Milner, a computer scientist who used to be a professor here. In fact, I worked with Martin Odersky to do a design for how generics might be added to Java. It started out without generics, and we did a design showing how it might be added, and then we worked with people at Sun, and that was picked up and became part of the Java design. So generics in Java came directly from the functional world. There's another feature that you're going to learn. Yes, question.
I'm sorry, I still understand what generics are exactly.
You'll learn later, but they are parameters to types. So instead of just saying you have a list, you can say I have a list of integers or a list of doubles or whatnot. Thank you. That's a good question. I hadn't explained that well. List comprehensions, which you'll, don't ask me what they are yet, but you'll know in a couple of weeks. And these have been added now to many programming languages, including C# and Python. C# in particular, it was a member of the Haskell community, Eric Meyer, who then went off to work for Microsoft, who got these into C#. And there's something called type classes that we'll learn a little bit about later in Haskell, and that's now showing up in C++ as something called concepts. So I just want to make the point that in what used to be the functional programming ghetto, many ideas would escape from that ghetto and get out into the mainstream. And I'm realizing that as the world is changing, the functional languages themselves are getting to become mainstream. So maybe I don't need to emphasize so much that features from them are also becoming mainstream. Okay, so that's the background. That explains why I think it's worth learning something about a functional language and why we're going to start there. So let's begin. So the first thing that you need to learn, so before I begin, any questions about the administration of the course or functional languages in general or why we're doing what we're doing? Has that been covered well enough? Yes.
Are these slides available on the website?
These slides are available on the website, yes. And as I say, there should be videos of these talks available on the web as well. It takes a few days for them to get up. Okay, so in functional programming, you will not be too surprised to learn that the most important thing is the function. So I think you all know about functions from secondary school, right? How many people think they know what a function is? Okay, pretty good. So there are various ways of thinking about what a function is. So you might think of it as a recipe, given this input, produce this output. So the squaring function would have the recipe, given a number, multiply it by itself, and return that as your output. You might think of it as a set of input-output pairs. So this tells us 1, 1 says that the number 1, its square is 1. The number 2, its square is 4. The number 3, its square is 9. Number 4, its square is 16, and so on. You'll all be familiar with seeing these as an equation, right? So f is the squaring function if f applied to x is equal to x squared. Many of you probably will have seen that written f open parenthesis x close parenthesis is equal to x squared. That's a more traditional notation. But in Haskell, we end up just writing the function next to its argument. And finally, right, if your function is a function over numbers, which is what we've discussed so far, then you can also graph it. So typically we use x for the argument and y for the result. And if you graph out this particular equation so that, right, here's point 1, This is distorted. This is definitely distorted. I don't know why. So that means that the scale for the y-axis here is squinched compared to the scale for the x-axis, because we know 1, 1 somewhere appears on this, and then 2, 4, and so on. And this shape is a squinched parabola. Okay. Any questions about that? Because that's fairly important. Okay. So once we've got the idea of a function, now, those were functions over numbers, but the nice thing in functional programming is we don't just operate on numbers. We do operate on numbers. We operate on integers. We operate on numbers with decimals in them, which we usually call floating point numbers. We can operate on character data. We can operate on strings, which are lists of character data. And we can operate pretty much on anything you can imagine. So one thing we're going to talk about operating on a bit is pictures. Question?
Does that mean that other types like arrays and lists fall into the categorical structures rather than types of data?
Oh, very good point. You get lots and lots of different kinds of structures of data, including arrays and lists. We'll be saying a lot about lists later in this course. And in fact, there is an example of a list here. A string is just a list of characters. But you're right, lists of data are a very important way of structuring data, which I've not mentioned in this list yet. So we'll be getting on to that. Good question, thank you. Yes? Ah, very good point. So in fact, integers and floats are usually stored in a single word of computer memory. Words are usually 32 bits or 64 bits. And 64 bits, you can store a lot of integers in, but there are even more integers that you can't store in 64 bits, right? Because there are an infinite number of integers, and 64 bits is finite. So indeed, quite often one operates on data that has a finite range. And usually, we won't consider the fact that it has a finite range, but sometimes that becomes absolutely vital. So that's a good point. Similarly for floats. Right. So Haskell, in fact, has a type called integer, which means arbitrary precision integers. It will store an integer as big as there is memory in your computer to do it. There's still more integers that won't fit, of course. But usually, you don't need to bother with them because they're too big to be interesting. So there's a type called integer that will store things as big as you want, as well as a type called int, which is just 32 or 64 bits, I forget which. Similarly, there are types float, which has a certain amount of precision, double, which has twice as much precision as a float, which is why it's called double, but not infinite precision. There's also something called rational, which is the ratio of two integers, and so can be as precise as there's room in the computer memory. So in fact, we have a choice between finite data with a range or data with essentially no range other than the limit of the computer memory. Yes?
Does the rational tape store a value as a decimal before it stores it versus stored as
a rational is actually stored as a pair of integers, numerator and denominator. But most of these fine distinctions we won't need to worry about. What I will mention is I mentioned Erlang has very high reliability. So one way they got that is they didn't want to have to worry about integer overflow. Right, you have a little counter counting how many phone calls you've made, and somebody's actually, you know, people have used the network to make more than 2 to the 32 phone calls. They didn't want it to fall over when that happened. So in Erlang, all numerical data is stored as an arbitrary precision integer, not a fixed place integer, in order to increase reliability. Okay. So to get the idea of function as something abstract, and also because it's a little bit fun, one of the things we're going to start by talking about is pictures. So, let's see. We can actually start with pictures first or numbers first. What would people like to see first, numbers or pictures? I'll start with pictures. I plan pictures, I'll start with pictures. So, let's just... Right. So which directory am I in? Here I am running Emacs on a terminal on my computer. I'm just going to see where I am. So here are the files in LabWeek. And one of them is something called labweekchess.hs. So let's run it. Okay, and now I can do, what is it, render night. So this should draw a picture of a night. And it loads all the different modules it needs. There are quite a few. And that stops. What's it done? Well, it's stored the answer somewhere. And let's just move these books away for a moment. If I look in. It should be in the file there. There it is. So it's rendered our night right there. The other one. So now I can put two nights next to each other. Render night. So we've got a function called beside. Rendered that. Let's go back. And I just need to refresh the page so I can see the difference. Two nights next to each other. So let's write a function. Double. Oops, let. Double. Of p, right? So this is just an equation. Double of p is equal to beside of p and p. So it's going to put something beside something. Yes?
Why is the next p in
your
browser?
Why am I finding the pictures in my browser? Emacs doesn't know how to do pictures. I have to put the pictures somewhere with some program that knows how to display it. And the library we're using uses the browser to display pictures because browsers are good at that. Good question. Thank you. So I've defined double of p to be beside of p and p. So right, render is the thing that shows the picture in HTML. So if I say render double of night, that should give us the same picture as before. So if I refresh, ta-da, it's the same as before. That's not too exciting. What will I get if I do this? Four nights side by side, right? Two nights side by side, side by side. Yes? Sorry, can I? Ah, right, so you mean, here I said double of p.
Yeah.
Could I have used double of x instead? Absolutely.
Can you use a word as well, or does it have to be?
And I can use a word, yes. So I could have said double of pick equals beside of pick and pick. So you can use any word you want, as long as it's made out of letters, as long as it's not used with some other meaning. That's actually very important. It's called the principle of renaming. And in Church's original work on the lambda calculus, which you'll learn more about, back in the 1930s, he had an equation saying you could replace a name by any other name. And the equation's name was alpha. So we often call this alpha renaming. So if you ever hear me use alpha renaming, don't panic. All it means is you don't need to choose P. You can choose any name you want as long as you use it consistently. Okay, so double, double, night will give me four nights side by side. And what will happen if I do this? 8, right? It's doubled, doubled, and doubled again, so it will be 8. Can I do a triple? Sure. Let's check and see if this worked first. So will we get 8? Yes! Okay, and now let's do triple. Let. And how do you want to define that? Beside PP. Okay? I'm not sure what else is there. I guess King must be there. Let's try it. Yep, seems to like that. Three kings. Now, beside PP, right, there are other ways we could do it. Yeah? So you say, I want to render two things beside each other, a double knight and a triple king. Does that answer your question? Okay. So there are a couple of things to notice here, right? I need to put the parentheses in so that it knows. If I just wrote double knight, triple king, it'll get confused. Right, so you need to show that these are in groups. Let's see if that one works. Okay, just as we expected. There are other functions like above. Them above each other instead. Let's see how that works. Like so. Notice it's aligned things on the left. There are other ways it could have aligned things.
The expressions in the brackets that they evaluate from the brackets right.
Sorry, what's the question? The order of the nesting of the brackets. So let's say something about that. Notice I said for triple, let's define a different triple, triple prime, also P, right? I'm going to define this one differently. Beside P, P, P. How will that compare with triple? It will be the same, right? In fact, in general, we have in general, we have so let X, Y, and Z be any three different or even the same pictures. That and that will always be the same. Can people see why? Okay. Any questions about that? Sorry? The brackets are so that we've got beside always takes two things. So here's one thing, here's the other thing. Beside always takes two things. Here's the first thing, here's the second thing. Okay? The brackets are essential. Without the brackets, the computer will just complain. Render, beside, let's try to do three things, right? Night, night, night. It says, what are you talking about? That's a very long-winded way of saying, I don't understand. We'll learn how to decode those messages later, but for now, it's just telling you what you've written makes no sense to me. So you need the brackets, right? If we did just what we had there, without the brackets. One thing, it's hard to read, but also the it is hard to read. The computer can't read it or make sense of it. So you need the brackets. Now, this law has a name. Does anybody know what the name is? It's called associativity. It says the order in which you do these things doesn't matter. There's a much more common way of writing it. So we have a cheat in Haskell. When a function has two arguments, sometimes it's very helpful to write it in the middle. And so we often write things like this. This character here is called a back quote. And on my keyboard here, it is located, where is it? Underneath the tilde, just to the left of the Z. Right, you'll find where it is on your keyboard. It's called the back quote. And if we write things in the middle, right, so remember this said the first thing is x and the second thing is beside y, z. And that's what we've got here. The first thing is x and the second thing is beside y, z. Here, the first thing is beside x, y, which is what we've got here, and the second thing is z, which is what we've got there. So this and this are just two different ways of saying the same thing. And now, it's much easier to see what associativity is about. It's about where the parentheses go. And now it's okay to write it without any parentheses at all because, well, the computer will figure out to put the parentheses into the left or right. I can't even remember which one it does. And it doesn't matter because it's associative. So where the parentheses go doesn't matter. Isn't that cool? Right? This is the power of mathematics. It's associative, so I don't need to care about where the parentheses go. This is great. The associative law is your friend. Remember it and make friends with it. It's very important. Yes? Right, the back quote notation works for functions with exactly two inputs. It's no good for functions with one input or with three inputs or with 15 inputs, just for two. But two is a very important special case. So there's the associative law for you. And I guess we can do this, right? We can say render night beside king beside double queen. Okay? Let's try that one. Just as we want it. I didn't need to worry about where the parentheses go. Question?
I was wondering if you write let beside p equal to beside p open parentheses beside p would work.
Let beside p. Oh, this is a new function. Let's call it f, shall we? P. Ah, Right, so you wanted to define a function with four arguments, sorry, with three arguments instead of one argument. And the answer is yes, you can do that, but we won't call them PPP. Let's call them PQR. The three different things need three different names. And that's a function that will put three things beside each other. Okay? Yes? Oh, what does it mean when a function has an apostrophe with an end? So there are rules about what consists of a name in Haskell. So a name in Haskell might be A, or it might be hello. Right, so I could define, or it might be F. Right, so I could define let F of hello equals beside hello, hello. And then one thing you can do with a name is add a prime to it, and that's a different name. So F prime is just a name. The prime symbol is the close quote, and that is on my keyboard underneath the double quote, two characters to the right of the L. You'll find it on your own keyboard. It just is like it's part of a name if it appears at the end. Okay, question in the back. Right, the one thing that you can use any names you want, but all the names for different things have to be different. So if you've got a picture called beside, then you better not call your functions beside and vice versa. So just pick all your names to be different. Okay, there's lots more to cover, but we're at the end of the lecture. You're far enough along, and we'll continue from there next week. All do your labs. See you next week. Thank you. Do you want to write down what you wrote that went wrong? For next Monday, you should have. Good question. You should have asked this in class. 1 to 3 normally was supposed to be for this week, but obviously you couldn't get done. So for next week, yeah, for next week you have to do 1 through 3 and 4 through 7, so a huge amount.
1 to 7.
Yeah. It'll get easier after that. Yes.
Do you know the person?
Yeah, I've met him. Yes. Yeah, no, Xponed was neat because it used to be people would say, well, I want to do my Windows rendering in a functional language because it'll be nicer. But, you know, I realize I have to pay something for this in terms of efficiency. And so people who are really determined would build their operating system stuff in functional languages. And it would be really nice, but it would be slow. Yeah.